Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Two spots up today, along with some extended commentary. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear from Leonie Hamson, who runs Class Size Matters on the new leadership at the New York City Department of Education, with one media exec slated to succeed another. Since New York's educational experiments have been seen as a model all over the U.S. and even abroad, this story is of far more than local interest. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Berkeley geography professor Dick Walker on California's economic, social, and political crisis. Before that, and before some comments on the news, a few words on the Pacifica situation. I did this show on WBAI in New York for 15 years. I was given the show by our late program director, Samori Marksman, who was a very intelligent and charismatic man with contacts all over the world. After his early death at the age of 52 in 1999, a death I'm certain was hastened by the pressures of Pacifica infighting, he was succeeded by an endless procession of oddballs and mediocrities. The latest in that devolving series decided that my show's frequency should be cut in half. I was already exhausted by the endless crisis and rot at WBAI, and this was the last straw, so I quit. I'm going to continue to do this show for KPFA, something for which I'm very grateful, and also for what I've learned recently is a large, loyal, and truly global internet audience. And I do want to thank that audience for their outpouring of support over the last couple of weeks. It's been very gratifying and touching. WBAI can run it if and when it likes, but while the current gang remains in charge, I won't be setting foot in their studios again. I hope I can keep doing this show for KPFA. But I've also been distressed by the goings-on around here, instigated by a Pacifica leadership that seems to be way out of its depth. This network consists of five powerful stations in very large metropolitan areas, but it now looks to be run by provincials with the assistance of people who think that pirate radio should be our model. Being radical and listener-sponsored shouldn't mean amateurish. Marginality is no proof of authenticity. Eviscerating the show with the biggest audience and the strongest fundraising appeal isn't the way to reverse a financial crisis and to build the audience over the long term. I hope I'll be sticking around here, but you never know, given the whimsy of management and some of the people on the local board. Okay, enough housekeeping, although it makes a convenient pivot point to observe that almost every institution in American society looks to be caught in some sort of suicide attempt. On to the news. Let's start with the recommendations of the co-chairs of that dreadful deficit commission. Clearly Obama's intention in appointing this thing was to create political pressure for some sort of bipartisan package that would get rammed through Congress with little debate. The screaming coming from the far ends of the spectrum would bring a smile to every orthodox centrist who loves to spread the pain around, not that the smiling centrists would feel much of the pain themselves. Here's how a far leftist screams about this thing. First, the proposals aim to cap federal spending at 21% of GDP forever. That's a very low number. It would preclude any sort of serious social democratic initiatives like single-payer health care or good public child care or free higher education, and would make very difficult any sort of infrastructure or green technology investment program. But of course, that must be part of the idea. Its recommendations on Social Security are almost all terrible. The only good thing would be to increase the level of income over which one need not pay Social Security taxes. They'd keep some limit, just raise it. But eliminating that cap entirely would eliminate the system's alleged long-term problems forever, according to estimates by the Congressional Budget Office. They'd raise the retirement age to 69, work until you drop. They'd change the formula for cost of living adjustments, COLAs, to a less generous version of the Consumer Price Index, even though an experimental price index for elderly households, kept by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, has increased more rapidly than the official one over the last couple of decades. And they wanted to use an even meaner one for adjustment purposes than the official index. There's also a sinister but superficially just proposal to increase benefits at the bottom and trim them at the top. That might sound good, but this fits in with a long-term elite scheme to turn Social Security into a welfare program. The non-poor would be expected to fend for themselves in retirement, which is something that rich pundits find easily imaginable, but maybe not so the rest of us. Chipping away at the top will reduce support for Social Security and will lubricate the route towards making it a welfare program. And as the old saying goes, programs for the poor are poor programs. Medicare cost containment would consist of more copays and higher deductibles, more shifting towards consumers, the very ones whose COLAs would be cut because their expenses are allegedly going up so slowly. They also propose to cut military spending by about $100 billion a year. It's nice to see the Pentagon on the chopping block. It's often exempted from these exercises. But since 2000, the military share of GDP has increased by about 2 percentage points. Taking us back to 2000 levels, when the military was hardly running bake sales to fund itself, would save $300 billion a year, three times as much as with this commission's proposing. On the tax side, they'd eliminate a lot of deductions and lower tax rates. Supposedly, this would have limited distributional impact, but I don't believe it. I'd love to see the mortgage interest tax deduction go. It makes no sense for the government to subsidize homeownership, and the lion's share of the benefits go to upper-income filers, but it's impossible to imagine such a thing ever getting through Congress, so it's hard to figure out why they even mentioned it. In his New York Times column on Friday, the revolting David Brooks suggested that we need a program of national greatness to restore American preeminence, a program he has the chutzpah to compare to the civil rights movement. He actually wrote this sentence in the column: "Are you really unwilling to sacrifice your Social Security cost of living adjustment at a time when soldiers and Marines are sacrificing their lives for their country in Afghanistan?" To Brooks, squeezing the old would be as heroic as imperial war. My God. Instead of a program of national greatness, could we have one of national decency? We do have a long-term budget problem. You can't run giant deficits forever. But the way to solve the problem is to slash military spending and tax the rich. In Robert Penn Warren's novel All the King's Men, the political figure at the center of the story, Willie Stark, modeled on Huey Long, began his career delivering long, dull policy addresses. His advisor, the novel's narrator Jack Burden, advises Stark to drop the wonkery and just say he's going to soak the fat boys. I love that. Let's soak the fat boys. They're mostly not fat anymore, and they're not all boys, but you get the idea. And now onto quantitative easing, known to connoisseurs of finance as QE2. Basically, this refers to the Federal Reserve buying $600 billion in Treasury bonds over the coming months. This is supposed to kickstart an economy that just won't recover. This buying binge will transform the Fed into the largest holder of Treasury paper in the world, comfortably surpassing Japan and China, which, by the way, has been reducing its stock of T-bonds. What these moves will actually do is mysterious. Banks are still not eager to lend to businesses or consumers, and many businesses and consumers aren't all that eager to borrow. A similar move was tried in the mid-1930s and didn't work at all. So the wad of cash that the Fed's buying will inject into the system could just sit there or get distracted playing complex and dangerous financial games. QE2 is actually a very poor substitute for fiscal policy. We need a long-term government investment program and a state-driven redistribution of income from top to bottom. We're not going to get that, of course. Instead, we get this murky program of dubious effect. But even that bizarre attempt at economic stimulus is too much for the austerity hounds at home and abroad. Some people on Wall Street are moaning, and Germans and other Europeans are also whining about excessive stimulus, the very people who are putting the periphery of their own continent through an austerity ringer. That austerity isn't having the presumed good effect. Greece and Ireland are in deep recession, and interest rates are rising there because the recessions are hammering tax revenues. Weak revenues make it hard to service debts, but servicing debts are what austerity programs are supposed to be all about. Britain, whose austerity program is still young and not yet bearing serious recessionary fruit, has also seen its bond yields rise, as investors expect the worst. At least British students rioted the other day. Could we please have some of that? Why are Americans so damned passive? Our president is also getting snubbed by his comrades in the G20. The forces of European austerity are moaning about stimulus, and the Asians are lecturing about the need for budget balancing. As at home, Obama has done a very poor job of making the argument for stimulus and against austerity. He could make some hay by pointing out the effects in the periphery of Europe that austerity programs are having, but of course that's not his instinct. I've already commented on the austerity party, but listening to Asians go on about profligacy is actually kind of funny. Their prosperity is the flip side of our profligacy. If China and the rest weren't stuffing container ships with goods for export to Long Beach and thence onto Walmart shelves, would they be enjoying 10% growth rates? It's funny how the successful always attribute their fortune to their own virtue and mount the lecture platform and hold forth at great length, isn't it? The U.S. did it for years, so I guess there's some rough justice in having the tables turned. Okay, let's take a musical break and we'll be back to talk about the schools.
And you're a prima ballerina in spring afternoon. Shane John into the Wolfman, howling at the moon. Oh, got a personality crisis, got it while it was hot. It's hard to know frustration and heartache when you die. Faith that Mother Nature sends, your mirrors damn dumb with all your friends. It's personality, everything's starting to blend all back to one. Personality, where your mind starts to bend. Personality, fashion of a friend of a friend.
That was a bit of Sonic Youth featuring Kim Gordon doing a bit of the New York Dolls song Personality Crisis from back around 1990 or 91. Earlier in the week, it was announced that the New York City Schools Chancellor, Joel Klein, would be leaving to go to work for Rupert Murdoch to advise him on how to make money off education privatization. Mayor Michael Bloomberg nominated Kathy Black, head of Hearst's magazine group and the former publisher of USA Today, to succeed him. Amazing. Klein didn't have any education experience when he took office, and she doesn't either, but that doesn't matter. They and Bloomberg, and by the way, Obama and his education secretary, Arne Duncan, are all partisans of a marketized, competitive educational model, and they seem to think that teachers are mostly just problems and not professionals doing hard jobs that require actual skills. It's important to say that testing and privatization strategies don't work. My next guest will talk about the testing part. But there's also no evidence that charter schools do any better than the public schools do right now. They do offer some promise for cost-cutting and union-busting, though, and that probably is the key to their appeal. My own thought about all this is that the American elite have decided that there's no future for a lot of children, especially those from the bottom half of the income distribution, so the business of the schools, and it is becoming a business, is cutting costs while spewing a lot of high-minded rhetoric about excellence and accountability. Many experts find my analysis too cynical, and I don't know. In any case, here's an interview with Leonie Hameson, who runs an organization called Class Size Matters in Manhattan. Though it may sound at first like it's of just New York interest, it's not. The city's approach to schools has been emulated around the country and also in Britain and Australia. Leonie Hameson. First of all, let's start by talking about Joel Klein. What's your evaluation of his tenure? He's widely celebrated by corporate pundits and mainstream media and such.
Yeah, well, he's widely celebrated by corporate pundits, but he's widely hated here in New York City. And you would be hard pressed to find a parent, a teacher, or even an educator, an administrator or academic, who believes that what he's done in our schools has been helpful. Even many of the people who work at the Department of Education in private have nothing good to say about the man. So his policies, we believe, have been by and large destructive of conditions of learning for our kids. We have larger classes, more overcrowded schools, huge wait lists for zone kindergartens because the overcrowding has gotten so bad and they haven't built enough schools. And all the new charter schools and small schools that he's developed, I think more than 500 under his regime, have made the overcrowding problem worse, because each of them has, you know, many of them have been put in existing school buildings where the increased amount of administrative space and cluster rooms have eaten up classrooms, libraries, science labs. So we're really seeing a dire situation here that's going to be difficult to reverse course for any new chancellor, no matter how good he or she may be.
What about the pedagogical strategy? It's really a very test-centered thing, right?
It's a totally test-centered. What's really interesting is the Department of Teaching and Learning, which used to be the largest department at the Department of Education, is now one of the smallest departments and has only a handful of people. Meanwhile, the Department of Accountability, they call it, has increased hugely, actually been created under his watch, and increased hugely. So their whole notion of education reform is based on testing and data. And, you know, one of the problems is the data that they get is completely wrong, and the test results they misinterpret. So we have teachers getting paid for how much they improve test scores, principals getting bonuses for the same, schools being closed on the basis of inaccurate formulas that are based primarily on 1 year's increases or decreases in test scores, which statisticians say are 30 to 80% random. So typically a school will get an A 1 year and an F the next and an A again the next year, and they bounce up and down, and it's really very confusing to parents and really very, very destructive to schools, because even though the results are mostly in error or random, still, there's tremendous pressure on principals and teachers to teach to the test. So we have a huge amount of test prep going on in our schools, and other subjects like art, music, and science are being driven out of our schools at the same time. And deeper kinds of creative learning and problem solving are being ignored, all in the race to improve test scores. And what we noticed over the years is the state test scores results were getting better and better, and something like 90% of all our schools got A's last year based on these inflated results. And we've been talking about this for years because it was pretty clear to us how inflated they were, and that, in fact, you could randomly answer multiple choice questions on some of these tests and pass. And finally, in August, the State Education Department agreed with us and lowered the cut scores, which is to say they put them back where they should have been, as they were, you know, they raised the cut scores, excuse me. And all of a sudden, huge numbers of our kids were properly reported as failing, and all the gains of the Bloomberg Klein regime disappeared overnight.
Yeah, this is important to emphasize. This strategy doesn't even succeed on their own terms, right?
No, it doesn't succeed. And in fact, you know, we've looked at the NAEP scores, which are far more reliable. These are non-high-stakes tests that the federal government gives every 2 years to a statistical sample of fourth and eighth graders. And so there's much less emphasis on teaching to the test. There's much less cheating that's going on, and the tests are very carefully equilibrated from year to year so that we know they're of equal difficulty, and so the results don't get inflated in the same way. And New York City's results on the NAEPs have been very, very disappointing. In general, we've seen no significant narrowing of the achievement gap, even though Bloomberg continually claims to have narrowed the achievement gap, and in fact said so again during his press conference yesterday. And we see blacks and Hispanic students in New York City falling further behind their peers in other cities across the country. And you can tell that by looking at those subgroups on the NAEPs. 10 other cities have been tested since 2003 on the NAEPs, and in every single grade and subject, black and Hispanics have fallen further behind. And one of the more interesting statistics that I uncovered was that among non-poor students, which is, of course, shouldn't be our primary focus, but should be of concern for parents as well. Among our non-poor students, we are the only city in the country that has lower average scores on the NAEPs in every subject and in every grade now than in 2003. The only city in the country. So clearly all this emphasis on high-stakes accountability has not worked to improve real learning in our schools. We need to go another direction.
Now let's comment a bit about this remarkable transition. When I heard the news yesterday, oh my God, and everyone I told said, oh my God, but Klein is going to work for Rupert Murdoch at News Corp, and he's being replaced by Kathy Black, who comes out of the Hearst magazines, and I think she was at USA Today before that. It's just amazing, this personnel at the top. Tell us what your thinking is about this.
Well, first of all, it's not an absolute done deal yet. She still needs a waiver from the state education commissioner, and we're hoping that she won't get it because there are very specific requirements in the law that say you have to have educational experience, and she has none. Now, Jill Klein got a waiver, so perhaps she will as well, but there is a huge consensus among pretty much everybody in New York City that we need an educator this time, someone who really knows what our kids need to succeed, someone who will really focus on improving classroom conditions rather than creating this whole bureaucracy around testing and so-called accountability. Joe Klein and his minions have admitted at city council hearings many times that they have no idea how to improve our schools, and that's why they put all the emphasis on the results rather than actually reforms that affect the classroom and that will improve and support our schools. And we need someone in that job who actually does have an idea about how to improve learning. Our class sizes in New York City remain the highest by far in the state and some of the highest in the nation. We have teachers who have 170 students a day. He wants to close 47 schools this year, many of them with very, very high class sizes and terrible conditions. And we've had budget cuts, huge budget cuts for 3 years in a row. We need somebody in that role who understands that teachers cannot teach and students cannot learn in the conditions that they are confronted with right now in New York City schools.
Now, this isn't just a New York City story, right? Klein's influence is spread around the world.
Unfortunately, that's true. He's a big idol in Australia, where the Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, has taken his reforms on as a model for some of hers in Australia, where they're now going to impose the same kind of high-stakes testing and school report cards that have failed so miserably here in New York City. What's very interesting is actually Klein was not the first. He took a lot of his ideas from a guy named Sir Michael Barber, who used to work for Tony Blair under the Labor government, and now Barber is at McKinsey and has worked with Joe Klein. And in the UK, they put together a lot of the same proposals that we've seen in New York with many of the same destructive effects. They imposed high-stakes testing from an early age and these things called league tables, which claim to talk about how effective schools are, but are actually very flawed and penalize schools with large numbers of high-need students, students who are poor, immigrants, or special education students. And there's been a huge revolt against that regime in the UK, and in fact, one-fourth of all the teachers did a boycott of the national tests last year, which would be something very good, by the way, for the U.S. unions to emulate if they ever got up the nerve. So now the new government, the new conservative government, ironically, is reconsidering that course, has now created a commission to approve recommendations to eliminate the high-stakes testing in the league tables because there's a general recognition that they have not worked to improve the schools. All they have done is created test prep factories where kids are just preparing for high-stakes tests but aren't really learning anything at all.
I'll speak with Leonie Hampson, who is the executive director of Class Size Matters. What is the logic behind this? Do they really believe this? Or a cynic might think that they figure there's no future for a lot of these kids, there are no jobs, the economy stinks, and what they really want to do is cut costs and impose at least some discipline on young people, and they really don't care about results over the longer term. Is that too cynical interpretation?
Well, there's some people who argue that. I actually believe that they think that they're this is the right way to improve our schools based upon a theory of competition that in their mind works in the business world. So you give everybody the same resources and you watch which schools succeed and which schools fail, and you close as many as possible that are failing and put new ones in its place. Something like if you had a, McDonald's franchises. So there are always a lot of McDonald's around. Some of them are going to succeed. Some of them are fail. We don't really mourn the loss of a McDonald's because we can find another one someplace else. But it's no way to treat kids. It's no way to treat teachers. And what they seem to fail to understand is that in many, many parts of the country, specifically and especially in large urban centers with a lot of poor people, schools are the anchors of their communities and their neighborhoods. And when you close a school down, it's a tragedy. And the kids in that school at the time, what we've found is huge numbers of them are discharged without having a chance to graduate with a regular high school diploma. And what we've also found in New York City is that when you close one school, the new schools that they open in their place, whether they were public schools or charter schools, tend to exclude the neediest students. So those needy students, the ELLs, the English language learners, and the special ed students, or simply the students who've been held back several times, don't get accepted into those schools and go elsewhere and get concentrated in other regular public schools, and then those schools fail. And so it's just created this terrible domino effect across the city where many, many of our large high schools are now failing, even those that were celebrated previously and were doing a really good job for kids.
The McDonald's analogy is interesting because McDonald's sells a homogenous product. A McDonald's in Biloxi sells the same stuff as a McDonald's in Bed-Stuy.
Well, that's true. So this is a little bit different because their whole theory of competition is based upon providing a varied diet of different kinds of schools. So we have a high school directory with over 400 schools in it that you're supposed to pick from for your child and apply to 10. And if you're lucky, they get into one of their 10 choices. And if you're not lucky, they get, and thousands of kids every year don't get into any of their choices and are sort of at the bottom of the pack. So you go through this directory and you can't figure out what the hell is because a lot of these schools have no record and are, falsely claim to be providing programs that they don't provide. And a lot of the small schools, some of them are good, but a lot of them are bad and are also failing. And what we've seen in the small schools is they don't really have the resources to provide a lot of choice in terms of curriculum, extra credit activities, or even AP courses. So they're struggling under a tough budget regime as well, and simply do not even have the resources, a lot of them, to offer the services to bilingual students or special ed students that those kids are a need and are mandated to receive. So it's a pretty bad system altogether, and people who have to go through the high school admission process here, it may look good to have 400 schools to apply to, but it's really a very, very difficult and challenging process, which ends up with a lot of tears.
Bloomberg and Klein and presumably Black love charter schools. What, if any, role do you think charters should have?
What role do I think they should have?
Yes.
I think that charter schools are okay if, number one, you look at them as laboratories of experiment, which was their original rationale, and those that work try to apply those lessons to our regular public schools. And number two, if they find space outside the existing facilities. Right now we have a situation in New York City where they keep on cramming more charter schools into public schools where there's no space for them. And as a result, class sizes are going up and special ed kids who by and large are not enrolled or accepted into the charter schools are getting their services in hallways and in closets. So it's been disastrous in New York City because the fights in communities between parents over space are some of the most awful experiences you will ever see. And I don't blame the charter school parents for trying to find new opportunities for their kids. And I certainly don't blame the public school parents who see their kids getting shoved out and getting second-class treatment. But right now we have a situation of huge overcrowding in our schools. Enrollment is still going up. Class sizes are going up. We simply don't have space for charter schools in New York City public school buildings. And Joe Klein is providing that space, even though he really shouldn't be. And there are very few other places in the country where the chancellor would provide space in the buildings for charter schools. So he sees that as part of the overall competitive method to improve schools. We see it as, in New York City, further depriving New York City public school students, for whom he's directly responsible, of an adequate opportunity to learn.
And final question, what if by some stroke of luck, you got nominated to succeed Joel Klein. What would your strategy be?
Well, first of all, I wouldn't take the job because, again, I'm not an educator. I'm just a parent who's an advocate. And I really do believe that somebody in that job needs to have been a teacher at some point in their career who really understands what education is all about. And I think one of the problems with Joel Klein is he has complete lack of respect for teachers. He essentially wants to deprofessionalize the teaching force and allow principals to fire teachers right and left, no matter what their qualifications and their experience level. So I'm not qualified for that job, but if I were advising someone who took the job, what I would say is, let's look at the money we have, because they have actually increased the budget by quite a lot, and over the last few years they've gotten over $2 billion from the state in additional state funds in order to reduce class sizes, and instead class sizes have gone up. So and they've added over 10,000 out-of-classroom positions and yet subtracted 1,600 classroom teachers. And that trend is continuing now with the Race to the Top money and the school improvement grant money that they've gotten from the feds. They're hugely building up the bureaucracy at the expense of the classroom. So what I would say is, whatever funds we have available, either from the state or the federal government or the city, I would use that money and invest it in the classroom. That's where kids learn, that's where teachers teach, and that's where we need to improve conditions in order to improve outcomes for kids. We cannot be a city where half of our kids in many parts of the city are in kindergartens of 25 and up. That is simply unacceptable in this day and age, especially when the research is crystal clear that small classes make a huge difference to kids, especially in the early grades, and that a lower class size in kindergarten will put you in good stead in terms of higher numbers, significantly higher numbers of kids going to college and having good salaries and owning their own homes years later. So I would take every penny I had and invest it in the classroom. And if the bureaucracy has to shrink, if we have to get rid of teacher merit pay, which, by the way, there are many, many, many studies now show don't work at all to improve outcomes, if we have to get rid of wasteful programs like more and more tests every single year for our kids and interim assessments and accountability systems that don't work to improve outcomes, and all the bureaucrats that have now accumulated at the school level and at the district level and the central level under this administration, let's get rid of them or put them into the classroom. Another thing that I would do is, we have over 1,000 teachers on absent teacher reserve right now. That means all the schools that Joel Klein has closed, they haven't been able to lay off their teachers, but they haven't been assigned to a regular class either. And we're spending over $100 million a year on absent teacher reserve. These teachers are paid full salary and aren't assigned to a regular classroom. Let's put those teachers back in the classroom where they belong, to lower class size.
That was the excellent Leonie Hamson of Class Size Matters. You can find her on the web at classsizematters.org. That's all one word with three S's in a row. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood. The program is Behind the News. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about California's crisis. That was some of Olivia Tremor Control doing California Demise, Part 3. No need to wear seatbelts, they've already died in the California Demise. Well, not really, I hope. But sometimes it does seem that way, at least from a distance. Here's Richard Walker, a professor of geography at Berkeley, to talk about California's multiple crises. Apologies for the quirky sound. This was recorded in a room at Berkeley's Hotel Durant on a misbehaving microphone. Richard Walker. Oh, welcome, Dick. I hear California's having some economic troubles.
Well, the recession here, the Great Recession, is probably worse in California than anywhere else in the United States. I mean, you can find a state like Nevada or Arizona where some figures are worse, but they're so much smaller, it just doesn't compare. We have 2 million unemployed. We have 12.5% unemployment that's hanging tough, and underemployment is probably 24%. You go out in the Central Valley, east of San Francisco, out in the agricultural areas that now have become suburbs, and the unemployment goes up to 27%, 33% in some of these counties. So it's catastrophic, actually.
I'm gathering this is just in a matter of the business cycle, something longer term, more structural going on?
Well, I'd have to say California has had such a disastrous housing bubble, and there's something that's been happening for at least 30 years, maybe 40 years, in that California housing market of being exaggerated, financial bubbles, and every time we've kind of led the way down. And that probably speaks to some even more structural problems in the basic economy, as in the whole United States. But in California, it's probably more serious for the United States, because this, after all, has been the leading edge economy of the U.S. for the last 50 years, probably.
What happened? It used to be, dreamland for the rest of the country, and now the dreamland has turned into something less pleasant. What happened to derail the dream?
Well, I think the first thing would be inequality. California's been leading the way in inequality. We're one of the top five states in inequality, one of the top five in growing inequality. We have more billionaires on the Forbes 400. We have more millionaires than any other state by far. So, and you've got pretty stagnant wages for the bottom half of the population. So the working class is not doing very well. And then you've got this massively bloated housing market. And that's what led to the catastrophic excess of subprime mortgages here and foreclosures, that people were trying to close that gap between income and monstrously overpriced houses by going into debt. There's also problems like in electronics. One of our leading sectors, which is very dynamic, is the leading sector in the country in offshoring. Hollywood still doing pretty well, but aerospace, a lot of that's moved out. And the biggest sector in Southern California now is probably logistics, which is, the L.A. Long Beach port, the biggest port in America by far now in terms of containers. And they're moving all these containers from China and Southeast Asia through the port. But it's not just the port. It's all the warehousing, all the trucking, the trains. It is this massive complex that reaches all the way out past Riverside. And that's a huge employer. But what are you doing? You're basically moving in the goods that are undermining American manufacturing.
I was just reading in the Financial Times that venture capitalists of Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley are now looking to Asia for a lot of their business. Is the Silicon Valley dream drying up?
Well, they are doing that, and they'd be fools not to. Pretty much all finance in America is looking that way if it can. However, I will put in a plug. This is unusual for me to plug the capitalists, but the Silicon Valley venture capitalists are some of the only finance capitalists in America are still actually interested in production. So they've been backing solar energy, green economy. You know, they're looking for real stuff, and real stuff in the U.S. So they're not just running abroad by any means. But they're having a tough time because, given that the U.S. has completely punted on green technology and climate change policy, a lot of what they thought was going to be a fruitful new arena for California innovation has not come to pass.
Can those sorts of new green technologies, the solar energy, all the alternative energies, whatever, be turned into a fruitful sector for capital accumulation without more heavy involvement by the state?
Oh, I think not. I think you just have to have, first of all, you have to have strong regulation, legislation for energy conservation. If you don't have that, there's no incentive, and we'll just go on burning coal because it's cheap and the coal industry is so powerful. At the same time, of course, some subsidies, tax subsidies are probably necessary, but I think that's less important than just getting conservation regulation and then some programs in which the federal government takes the lead, the way the state government actually has already done in California. And that's more weatherizing, retrofitting, complex power networks where you can plug in all different kinds of energy sources back into the grid, that sort of thing.
You mentioned some of the things that California is doing, but the state itself is in the most dire fiscal situation imaginable. How bad is it, and is there a way out?
Yeah, that's absolutely structural. On the one hand, you have the cycles, the business cycles, and every time a business cycle comes down in California over the last four cycles, going back to the early 1980s, we go into massive deficit. And the last three deficits have been by far the biggest of any other state in the recessions, and disproportionately large. For example, last year, out of about $120 billion in deficits of all the states, California had $34 billion. This year, it's $19 billion out of about $100 billion. And given that we're only 12% of the population, 12% of the economy, that's greatly disproportionate. So something is clearly wrong here. Something's rotten in our fiscal system.
Is it the economic structure or the tax structure that's really the problem, or both?
Well, it's mostly the tax structure. The economic structure was whipsawed pretty badly by all these financial bubbles we've had. But I would put the biggest blame on the tax structure, which used to be excellent in the post-war period. California had a very progressive tax structure. We had high income taxes for the top brackets. We had corporate taxes, even businesses doing from out-of-state corporations and so on. And then we had good property taxes. But with Proposition 13 and other tax reforms, a lot of that has been set aside. We've replaced it overwhelmingly with sales taxes or things like parking meters and parking tickets. So what we now have, we've gone two things. We've gone from being one of the top states in tax effort, that is tax per capita GNP. And that used to be in the top, and it's now down in the 20s. So it's very middling for such an advanced industrial state.
Now, the conservatives, of course, said lowering the tax burden would unleash a boom. That hasn't happened.
No, in fact, it's been just the reverse. If you look at the figures for job creation, California was doing much better long ago. And the last two booms in the 90s and the 2000s, such as they were pretty feeble. And in fact, zero net job creation in the 2000s, kind of like the national economy, but maybe more surprising because California, up through the 80s, was way ahead of the rest of the country in job creation. Now, the other problem with the tax system is that we don't tax property anymore, and it's become incredibly regressive. Sales taxes on the one hand, no property taxes, and although our income tax does grab a lot of the capital gains in a boom, that disappears in a crisis. And the basic tax revenues that you need from property on taxes on wealth as well as income through property taxes have disappeared because of Proposition 13. So it's being made up in this extremely regressive way and inadequate way. We just don't have enough tax revenues.
And even something like a normal economic recovery wouldn't really address the structural issue of how the taxes are collected.
No, we absolutely are in sort of permanent fiscal crisis here. This has been a fiscal crisis, goes back to the recession of the early 80s, 90s, early 2000s, and now again. Nothing's new. Every time we just go off a cliff because we don't have an adequate tax base. And in the boom periods or in the upswings, the Democrats who dominate the legislature have been able to push through some kinds of tax, you know, increases in tax rates. Although there hasn't actually been a real tax increase at the state level since, I think, 1994. So you've just fallen way behind in what you have to do to raise revenues to meet all the obligations, the health care obligations, the infrastructure obligations. There's so many things, education. And the result is that California has absolutely fallen off the face of the map in terms of progressive spending, progressive investment by the state.
I'm speaking with Richard Walker, who's a professor of geography at the University of California, Berkeley.
Well, let's talk a bit about your employer and the broader sector, the University of California, which is in crisis. You've got students occupying buildings, budget cuts, privatization initiatives, all sorts of things. Just give us a lay of the land of what's happening. What used to be one of the great treasures of California, is it anymore?
Well, you know, it's still good. We haven't ruined it yet completely, but it's being undermined in a variety of ways. Student fees are now up to almost $12,000 a year, which means you're not really talking public education anymore. They do provide state grants and federal grants that cover about the bottom third of the kids and do a pretty good job of that. But the middling classes, they're hit very hard by this. And the worst of it is the administration has become very top-heavy, very distant from students and faculty. And all the faculty are still working like crazy, and the students are trying to keep things, you know, are fighting and protesting. You have the sense administration, a lot of them would be just as happy to increase the privatization, keep raising fees, and basically go off into the happy nirvana of being a kind of little public Stanford or Harvard, rather than serving the people the way they should be.
Now, looking at some of the other state university systems, I've noticed that tuition and state support have almost reversed roles over the last 20 or so years. Whereas tuition was considerably less than state support, now tuition is much larger than state support. Is that true of the University of California system?
I don't know the total percentages, but there are calculations that show that the students already are paying more than what is spent on them. That is, the actual teaching function of the university probably costs less than what they're paying now. And they're actually subsidizing administration and research functions that they shouldn't be subsidizing at all. It is absolutely clear that state funding has fallen off dramatically, just year by year by year. And I should add, as an aging employee of the university, they haven't put any money into the pension fund for 20 years. Neither the state nor the administration. They were riding the stock markets, and that hasn't worked out too well. So now we're about, you know, $5 trillion in arrears.
And then what about the less elite sectors, the California state system? Is that that must be taking a bigger hit than the university itself?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we've been kind of protected until now, although it was being eroded and people weren't really focusing on that. If you looked at the California state system or the community colleges system, which is huge, these are the biggest public higher education systems in the country. They've just been nickeled and dimed, well, not nickeled and dimed, I'd say dollared and $20 to death over the every recession. So they have now, you know, over half part-time teachers. You've got crowded courses. They've been turning people away this year. It's just we have not kept up with the growth of the population, the growth of the student population, or maintaining the quality of our institutions up and down in terms of facilities or pay and teachers and so on. And then we keep raising fees on all of these kids.
Does the erosion of the educational sector have anything to do with the end of the California economic miracle?
Well, I think it does. I mean, I think you can argue that we may be running out of steam, just like the U.S. has run out of steam over the years. So we did great in the post-war period. We did great right through the 80s. In the 90s, we were still going great guns with electronics, but Southern California had fallen back. But then that blew up in our faces. So I think there's a case to be made that California may have run out of luck here. But again, I think we could pull it out of the fire. I don't like an argument that just says that it's economic inevitability, that you have to decline. I mean, look what the Germans do in terms of being the world's greatest exporter to this day with an incredibly high wage structure and so on, just by upgrading. And California could easily do that. I mean, what place in the world is better positioned than California to take the high road of upgrading labor, good education, upgrade skills, continue to innovate, and so on? This is what we did before, and this is what we could do again. But it requires more long-term vision. You have to have investment in your youth. You have to spend money on your education system. Our our K through 12 system has gone from the top five in per capita per pupil spending to the bottom five. We're down with Mississippi now. I mean, it's an absolute disgrace. So California is not investing in its children, and it's not been investing in infrastructure the way it did in the post-war New Deal era. And, you know, and then we have a government that's pretty much paralyzed by the right because we have these ridiculous two-third voting requirements on everything. And so really you have no leadership, you have no long-term investment. And I think that is definitely a formula for just going downhill and taking the low road and losing the greatness that was this state.
Well, this touches on one of my current obsessions, which is the state of the ruling class, which is, I think, very decayed and very, very short-sighted. And you know, I see that as the national level. But who exactly is the California elite? Who is the ruling class of California these days, and what are they thinking?
Well, that's a very good question, and that's not simple, but I agree with you about the degeneracy of the American ruling class. I think... Now, it's the military elite of Southern California, of course, were deeply implicated in the election of Ronald Reagan. Our agrarian ruling class is still extremely reactionary out in the Central Valley. That's not going to lead us out of this. The financial elite at one time seemed possibly innovative and progressive. There are elements of that still. But mostly they're pushing private equity funds and giant mutual funds, and I'm not sure they're that interested in the future of this state as opposed to their global investments. And so I think it doesn't look real good. The Silicon Valley guys, by and large, are obsessed with their own narrow interests in the Valley. You don't see a Silicon Valley elite that's really stepped forward to be sort of public leaders. You get more of that out of some of the old San Francisco elite or some of the Hollywood elite, in fact. But then, of course, what do we get? We get Schwarzenegger in the public sphere. And I think Schwarzenegger is a perfect cipher for the problems of California politics that go back to Ronald Reagan and Richard Nixon and beyond, which is that we have had a kind of media-driven politics for a very long time that's derailed from a party system, a solid party base. And so you constantly get these guys bubbling up who are pretty faces, but really don't have too much substance. And Schwarzenegger was like that. At the end of the day, he was going to save the state, and it's proved impossible because he won't address the structural difficulties. And if you don't address those, you can't solve the problems just by talking sweet talk or even compromise or anything. You have to address the real issues. You've got to change voting patterns.
That was Richard Walker, a professor of geography at Berkeley, who's been focusing on California for the last couple of decades. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another take on California apocalypse, Bad Religion's Los Angeles is Burning. Till next week, bye.